performer, obsessed with growth, and looking for an edge? Welcome to Mind Body Peak Performance. Together, we'll discover underground secrets to unlocking the full potential of your mind, body, and spirit. We'll learn from some of the world's leading minds, from ancient wisdom to cutting-edge tools and everything in between. This is your host, Nick Urban. Enjoy the episode. Welcome to another episode of Mind Body Peak Performance. I'm your host, Nick Urban, a Czech practitioner, data scientist, and holistic performance health coach. Every week, I bring you essential life skills, strategies, and tools not taught in school to help you build the ultimate high-performance lifestyle. It sometimes seems like certain humans are cut from a different cloth. They do things which defy logic and reasoning. Sometimes that's mental performance, or, as we saw recently with the Olympics, physical performance. Physical performance takes many forms, such as strength, power, or endurance. So much of health and fitness isn't physical, but rather mindset. Our guest today exemplifies exactly that. He went from zero background running to a whopping 9 marathons in 9 days. Who is he? His name is Matt Scarfo, and he's a human performance and corrective exercise specialist. Matt entered the fitness industry in 1999 at age 20. He entered out of interest in learning how the human machine was engineered, how it responded, how it adapted, and how it accommodated when exposed to stress and stimulation. Almost 22 years later, his curiosities have led him to explore the most fundamental aspects of adaptation of movement, exercise, diet, stress, injury, and disease. He's coached, trained, and mentored over 10,000 clients and colleagues, and is now in partnership with two of the major fitness education institutions in the United States. His passion lies in understanding and maximizing human performance. A man after my own heart, he's a practitioner, not a theorist, actively pursuing his own limitations and using his experience to teach, speak, and coach individuals and organizations to find their own personal best. This also marks the beginning of a month-long series on fitness and improving body composition. That's gaining muscle, reducing fat, and overall improving the way you look. Afterward, we'll continue exploring the supplement industry. One last word before we get started. If you haven't already, please leave a rating and review at the same place you downloaded this episode. That's what helps this show get found and how I continue bringing you thought-provoking guests. Okay, let's dig in. Enjoy this conversation with Matt Scarfo. I'm here tonight with Matt Scarfo, a human movement specialist and corrective exercise extraordinaire. Matt, how are you doing today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing pretty well. It's 8 p.m. over in our time zone in the Eastern time. Today, what have you done so far for your health and performance?
All right. So today's kind of an interesting day. I actually went to the hospital. I checked myself into the ER last night at about 10 o'clock because I thought I was having heart palpitations. And after all of the blood work came back, turns out that fortunately I don't have a heart problem. I've got rhabdo. So it was a mild enough case of rhabdo that they could discharge me. So for my health today, I just took it easy. It's uncharacteristic of me. I usually do a lot. But today, doctor's orders don't do anything.
Smart, playing by ear. And rhabdo is a subject we will unpack a little bit, especially amongst the athletes, the hard-charging folks. It's a real issue. CrossFitters, too.
That's it.
So what's taking you to this point?
Yeah. So I'm an amateur endurance athlete. I'm 42 years old and trying to outrun the Grim Reaper at this point. And one of my guiding philosophies for personal fitness is, if and when I do pass, I don't want it to be on a body that you know, that hasn't taken its lumps. I want to drive this thing until the wheels come off. I do it in a responsible way, but I certainly look for new and interesting ways of challenging myself. I'm an ultra runner in my own personal workouts. I do, you know, a number of different endurance feats, and, you know, I'll pick one exercise and do it for an hour and a half sometimes. But, you know, I've been in the fitness space for 22 years professionally, probably slightly longer recreationally, and in really just following my own curiosities of how this machine moves and how it works, to, you know, how can I maximize my potential and ignore the voice in my head that says, you know, you've probably done enough. You know, and one thing I've certainly realized is that there's another side to this coin. And for those of us that are fortunate to flip it over and see what's there, it's truly a space of unlimited potential. So I challenge myself, with the exception of today, each and every day. And I look for new ways to try to prove that theory wrong. And I've yet to find one.
Relaxing can be a challenge in itself. And sometimes it has to go on the calendar, be scheduled in to get adequate attention. Mm-hmm. On one of our previous conversations, you mentioned the body as being a combination of ropes, pulleys, and levers. Can you elaborate on that?
Yeah, absolutely. So my forte in the fitness space is the human machine, human movement, particularly the way that it moves, the way that it accepts and redistributes force, and you know, how to mechanically work around injuries or accommodate those injuries, so hopefully at some point in the future they just don't exist anymore, or at least they're not even on our radar. So the best way for me to describe how the human body moves and it helps me help my clients visualize it is that the machine itself is really made up of ropes, levers, and pulleys. Ropes being the muscles, lever arms being the bones, and pulleys being the joints. And I think that once you can visualize it in that way, it opens up a whole lot of doors when it comes to thinking about what proper form might look like, might feel like, and you know, what things we could do to maximize this machine's potential and maximize this machine's ability to do the things that we ask it to do for us.
When you work with someone, are there typical things that you find that once they understand the ropes, pulleys, and levers analogy, that they're able to change?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think that it works very well, because that kind of analogy, that specifically that analogy, helps us put into place these lines of similarity between movements that we wouldn't think necessarily would be related. So for example, a chest press and a squat, completely different parts of the body, completely different movement systems. But when we think about the mechanics of it, it all boils down to movement economics and movement efficiency. So, excuse me, when we line up and we do, you know, for example, a bench press, we want to make sure that in most cases our wrist is directly over our elbow and that our forearm stays perpendicular to the ground no matter which way we're looking at it, because this way we're generating force parallel and in direct opposition to the force vector, to gravity, as opposed to having too narrow of a grip and wasting some energy trying to bend the bar, or if we have too wide of a grip, we're inevitably wasting some energy to stretch the bar. And the same is true for squats. When we line up for a squat and we press off of the ground, we want to produce force that's in direct opposition to gravity. So in that case, we really want to put a lot of effort, in most cases, of keeping the knee over the ankle, for that matter, the knee over the heel. So this way, when we're driving up, the equal and opposite force is driving straight down. And if there's any mismatch, if the knees are too far forward, then the same as the bench press, we're wasting some energy trying to compensate for balance and compensate for the less than ideal movement economics of it. So there certainly is some crossover. There certainly is some congruence between our presses, you know, in our lifts and our pulls and so on and so forth. And when we visualize it in terms of ropes, levers, and pulleys, it kind of takes the mystique out of it. It brings it down to a digestible strata so we can visualize it more easily without thinking of muscles and muscle fibers and organelles and, you know, joint capsules, so on and so forth. So it certainly does help clients understand, especially the visual learners. It helps them understand the concepts in which that we were designed to move around.
Also sounds like it would increase your max squat or bench press in this case, and at the same time, reduce the likelihood that you'll get an injury.
That's the point. Absolutely.
So let's backtrack a little bit. You mentioned rhabdo. What is rhabdo, and how did it come into play with your current training routine?
Mm-hmm. So the way that I understand rhabdo, I'm not a doctor, but it's basically when the muscle, the skeletal muscle of our bodies has been traumatized some way to a point that it's breaking down and our body's got to absorb it and do something with it. And we can get rhabdo from a number of different ways. It's either blunt force trauma, if you fall off of a ladder, if you had a bad experience and a couple of dudes were hitting you with a bat in your legs, you know, that muscle's got, something's got to happen to that damaged tissue and it needs to get reabsorbed into the body. But that's not really what our kidneys really want to do. And it's particularly stressful on the kidneys. Often when it reaches a severe point, it's by way of the kidneys that we learn that there might be an issue. Sometimes some people explain it as they went to the bathroom and it looked like they were urinating coffee or Coca-Cola. It's extremely dark. It shows that the kidneys in the body is under stress. In my case, that wasn't it at all. The indicators of rhabdo came through, and you could also get it from overexertion, beating the hell out of muscles, overtraining muscles. And it's, depending on the person, it certainly takes a lot of effort to be able to do that. It's hard to do by accident. We found out about it. The doctor in the ER found out about it by way of my blood work. And she, you know, my inflammation markers were through the roof, among a number of other ones. And she came down and she said, you know, your blood work looks fantastic, except for, you know, you've got signs of rhabdo here, and these numbers aren't so terrible that we need to keep you, but you need to take a day off. Specifically, she said you should consider your age when you consider your workouts. And I told her that, with all due respect, ma'am, that's probably going to be the very last thing I do. But if it makes you happy, I'll take tomorrow off. And she says that doesn't, but that's today. And that's what I'm doing. I'm kind of being a little silly about it too. I mean, obviously if I feel like something's off tomorrow and things don't feel right or look right, then I'll obviously seek another medical professional's attention. But the way that I feel, I think I should be all right tomorrow.
And is there any one particular biomarker? I know that when I was overtraining, I went to the doctor one day and got blood work done, and a measure called creatinine was through the roof, and mm-hmm. It was because I had trained just before then, and then I came back a couple of days later after having not trained, and lo and behold, my huge risk, elevated risk of heart attack had completely dropped off. So what mm-hmm. was in your case?
It was certainly the creatinine. I believe that was a different panel that they ordered, but there was a number of other indicators, and I don't want to misspeak. Mm-hmm. There are a number of other indicators in there that show that the body is under stress and that muscle is being catabolized at that point and trying to be reabsorbed. But I'll tell you what was interesting. So I'm laying in the hospital bed, and you know, because of the medical system here in New Jersey, I don't know if it's like this anywhere else. Whenever there's a lab that comes through or a test result that comes through, I get it emailed to me and I can go to my online portal and view the results of it right away. So I'm getting the results of the lab before the doctor had come back. So and I'm kind of familiar with what some of these things mean. So I'm reading through it. I'm taking mental notes, the things that I didn't know, I'm looking up online, you know, and what I found in my own curbside research was that my red blood cell count was up, my lymph numbers were up, that there was something funky going on with my mitochondria and the red blood cells that were carrying the mitochondria. And I took a look out online and I came across an article, and it turns out that Sherpas that work at high altitudes, Kilimanjaro, Mount Everest, and so on, their numbers are pretty similar to what my numbers were during this test. And I found it interesting. And I also found it a little self-flattering that I do a lot of training with an elevation mask, an oxygen deprivation mask. And the last workout I did was on Saturday, and it was about an hour and 15 minute run. And I had the oxygen deprivation mask on. I'd say probably half of my workouts I use with it. And some people say that it's hocus pocus and that, you know, it doesn't really do anything and so on and so forth. I have looked into the science, and from what I've read, It does, actually. But this was the first time that I got to see the blood work, and I could draw a correlation between the people that work at high altitudes and live at high altitudes and the accommodations that their bodies have to make in order to survive in an environment like that. And while I'm working out on my own, simulating that environment, you know, on some days of the week, I saw those same numbers change. And for me, that was validation that, wow, you know, this shit really does, this shit might actually do something. So that was pretty interesting.
That sounds like a pretty hefty run. How did you get started with endurance running and those long distance types of events in the first place?
I was never really much of a distance runner. About 10 years ago, I started to get into running. And the purpose, the reason why I got into it was my wife and I had just gotten married. We planned on starting a family. And up until that point, for me, it was largely aesthetics. It was bodybuilding. It was strength training. I didn't really do much legs like a lot of people. I just really wanted big beach muscles. I wanted to look tough. I wanted to feel tough. So 10 years ago, I'm in my early 30s, and I had to make a decision that I want to be able to see my children grow up and live as much of their lives as possible. And in order for me to do that, I needed to focus not on the aesthetics of exercise, but more so on the benefits to longevity and just being fit in general. And that's a hard pill for somebody to swallow that weighs 205 pounds and they're jacked and they're ripped and they, you know, this is the identity that they've built. This is the identity that they've chosen. That was me. So I made the decision that I was going to be fit and I'm going to work out to be fit. No matter what that looked like, I had to be okay with it. And if that meant that I was lighter, that meant that I was lighter, but I would have to start doing things to improve my overall health. So I started running. I remember it took me about a year to finally break through 3.5 miles, 3.25 miles of 5K. And I remember the first time I ever ran that far, I came in and I told my wife, I'm like, I don't know why the hell anybody would ever like want to run that far. It sucked. I committed to doing it. So I continued to do it. And just like anything for, I began to challenge myself a little bit more and a little bit more. And I got myself up to 7 miles, 8 miles, 9 miles every once in a while. And this, you know, kind of accumulated throughout the years. Now, last year, I'm over here in New Jersey. We're still, they've certainly protracted the shutdown here in New Jersey for better, for worse, for right or wrong. But I had to shut my business down back on March 15th of last year as a result of the executive order that, you know, gyms, restaurants, basically all non-essential stuff just had to stop. 2 weeks to flatten the curve. About a month and a half later, myself and all the other business owners in New Jersey were starting to get a little antsy. We weren't getting much guidance as to what we would need to do and what things would look like once we were able to reopen. And there was no indication when we'd be able to reopen. It was just, you know, sit tight. So the business that I owned was in Morristown, New Jersey, which is about 56.4 miles away from Trenton, New Jersey. And it was a Sunday night at dinner. I looked up at my wife while we were eating and I said, you know what? I think I'm going to run to Trenton tomorrow. She's like, you're out of your freaking mind. So, you know, we talked about it. I was completely, I didn't prepare for it much. I didn't train for it. Just kind of threw the Osprey pack on my back with a couple of bars and drove to the gym at 4 o'clock in the morning and set out to head down there. And it wasn't really a matter of the distance. It was really more the theatrics of it. I wanted to bring attention to the cause, and I successfully did that. I mean, a couple of news stations picked it up, state newspaper picked it up. So took me about 12 and a half hours and I got my rocks off on it. I thought it was incredible. You know, I hit a wall or two along the way. I got through those walls. That was a sense of victory and a sense of accomplishment for me. And, you know, I got the itch. It was a cool thing. A month later, that was April 28th, a month later, May 23rd, I packed my bags and I ran from my house here in Northwest New Jersey, and I set out to run down to Washington, D.C. You know, I'll save the conversation I have with my wife for another time, but needless to say, she was a little surprised by that. But it ended up being 200, 411 kilometers. I think it was like 251 miles. Took me about 9 days. Not having been a distance runner before, longest I ran was, you know, just a month ago. And 9.5 days later, I got down to Washington, D.C., and I hit, you know, different walls, you know, different barriers, physical barriers, mental barriers, spiritual barriers. I mean, to be out on your own for that long in pain alone, you know, puts you in a really interesting place and gives you some, you know, some demons that you have to go back and fight again that you thought were long gone. And after I had done that, I said, you know what, I guess I kind of found myself being an ultra runner and started doing that. But with regard to other endurance activities, I've always been a fan of walking lunges. When I had the gym, I would do walking lunges on the treadmill to see how long I could do them for. And at one point I got to about a half a mile and I liked it. So I took it outside and started doing, you know, a couple of kilometers of walking lunges at a time. And I got into that. I got into really enjoying finding the headspace, that meditative headspace that you need to find in order to do repetitive, physically arduous tasks for an extended period of time. And I like that. So that really struck a nerve with me. That really turned me on to really grasping that now as, I guess, a part of my identity as bodybuilding and strength training was before I started running 10 years later. It seems that endurance activities and ultra running kind of found me.
You mentioned hitting a wall, and for a lot of us, myself included, I know that wall wouldn't even take a marathon. It wouldn't even take a half marathon. It would happen before that. And mm-hmm. when you're running a marathon a day for 9 days or more, how do you manage to overcome all those obstacles between you and DC?
That's a great question. So it is all relative, right? And for me, that wall was that 5K that I was talking about for a while. And when I finally got it, I felt like I stopped just short of that wall. I didn't attempt to climb it. I felt like that wall was just after 5K. For some people, it's 1 mile. For other people, it's, you know, 250 miles, right? For Courtney Dewalter, God knows what it is for her. After running nine marathons in 9 days, it only took me a couple of days to realize that there's people out there that shit all over that, right? So, you know, it was humbling, but it was mine. I owned it anyway. What I learned and the way that we did it was, we're coming up on the 1 year anniversary. The way that we did it was I just left with, in my bag, I had all the clothes that I had on me, which was like minimal. I had an extra pair of socks, a very light long sleeve shirt, which was really more of a sun blocker, and a very light hoodie. That was it. And, you know, a life straw, some snacks and stuff. And my wife, every night we would talk, we'd plot out where I would go next. She was home with the kids. And she would say something, for example, that was, you know, I've got a hotel for you at 23 miles and there's another hotel for you at 31 miles. There's nothing in between. So pick. You know, if you pass the first one, you're going to go for the long run and you got to get to the next one. Otherwise, you're not going to have a place to sleep. So we did that the entire time. I would say things really started to get tough around day three or four. And that's when everything really started to accumulate for me. And I wasn't able to block them out of my head. And I think everybody out there knows what I'm saying to some degree, you know. If you're working out and you feel a twinge, you kind of just bury it in your mind and you keep going. And, you know, whether it goes away or it doesn't, you manage to finish your workout. If it goes away and you're still doing something, you might feel something else, right? Another ache or pain or, you know, alarm goes off and you're able to put that out of your mind and keep going. After a period of time, you get tired. You can't push those things out anymore. And the four or five things that maybe you were able to bury up until this point, you no longer have the strength to keep them buried. So they come back. And we're talking, I've got like five toenails that are missing. I had stress fractures in my feet. Tops of both of my feet were black and blue. Looked like I had half a softball underneath my knee. I was taking on water on my knee. I actually considered going to Walmart and grabbing a needle and just draining it myself. But these things accumulate and you can't get past them. And when the physical body starts to break down, we rely on our mental state to really pull us through, right? In layman's terms, it's like, come on, man, you can do this one more step, so on and so forth. But there's another level to that. There's, I guess it would be the physical level, the emotional or the mental level, and then the spiritual level. And when you drag yourself through something that is physically painful to the point where your whole body is just screaming and you can't talk yourself through it anymore, what ends up happening is the voices in your head that used to be consoling and friendly, that were saying things like, you got this, man, just take it slow, you'll get there, it's no problem, one foot in front of the other, those voices turn on you. And I think that it's suffice it to say that, you know, when you think you've hit rock bottom, fucking hold on to your shorts, because this is only getting started. Rock bottom is so much farther down than a lot of people realize. And this voice in your head turns on you and starts saying shit like, you know what, man, you really shouldn't have done this to begin with. Well, actually, first it says things like, you know what, 110 miles is a lot, dude. You did good. A lot of people would respect you for 110 miles. You can call your wife up right now. She'll come and pick you up. You guys can have a cupcake. You can celebrate. Like, you did all right. And then when you ignore that voice for long enough, it gets mad, at least for me. And it says things like, dude, you're just not cut out for this. Like, what the fuck are you doing? Your body's falling apart. Go to the doctor, go to the hospital. Don't ever think about doing this again. And then you come up to a voice that says, you know, remember the time you did the Spartan race a couple of years ago and you got the DNF? This just isn't your bag, bro. This isn't for you. Give it up. You're not cut out for this. And then layer by layer by layer, you've got to go back and fight all the bosses again that you thought you beat, even ones that you beat, I beat when I was a child. Like, shit that I didn't even thought that I remembered came back to haunt me. And now I've got to reconcile that again. So what do you do when your body is just decrepit and turned on you, physical pain just everywhere? Your mind is now trying to talk you out of it. And it's saying the shit that only you know hurts that bad. Nobody knows these things about me. Nobody knows these things about you or anybody else, but you know these things. And that's when they come back to haunt you. So like, what happens? I remember being on the side of a road. I'm going to tell you guys a story. I remember being on the side of a road in a town called Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, middle of nowhere. Okay. Like, we've got, it's Amish country. So it's nothing but farmland, horse-drawn carriages, and, you know, overalls and flannels. So I'm on the side of a road in Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania, and I'm dragging my feet, literally dragging my feet. I couldn't walk. I was crying hysterically. It was a grown man, 41 years old, crying hysterically. Okay. I was hallucinating. I was exhausted. I was tired. And I just remember telling myself, like, this is when the spiritual component of it comes in, you know, wherever your beliefs lie. Something comes in and says, you know what? Let that voice say really whatever it wants, almost as though it's a TV playing in the background. As long as your feet are moving, you're good. Let it play in the background. Let it say whatever it wants. One foot in front of the other is going to get you there. And, you know, then it would flash back and, you know, painful stuff would come back. And nope, let it talk. It's fine. Just let it say whatever it wants. So I'm crying on the side of the road. I've got my head in my hands. I remember I've got sweat drip or tears dripping off of my elbow. And I get a phone call. Now, this is a day after the whole George Floyd thing started. Okay. And there's some, it's relative in some degree. My phone rings and it's a friend of mine. It's a friend of mine that I haven't talked to in years. We're friends on Facebook. You know, we follow each other, but my phone hasn't rung with his number on it. Never. The phone rang. I'm like, I have to answer this. He's a black friend of mine. So, you know, climate considered, you know, everything that was going on at the time. So I pick up the phone and I didn't say anything. I couldn't say anything. I was sobbing. And my friend says to me, he's like, Matt, I want you to know right now that I feel you, and I need to know what you need from me right now. And like, first thing I went through my head, I'm like, how did you know, man? Like, what do you mean you feel me right now? Like, I haven't talked to you in forever. He's like, I feel you right now. He's like, don't ask me how, I just know. What do you need from me? And I told him, I'm like, I need something, man. I want you to pray with me. And, you know, I'm a spiritual person. I'm a somewhat religious person. You know, I use God and universe interchangeably, whatever. I just needed somebody's spiritual attention. So I said, I want you to pray with me, man. He said, that's fine. So I heard him call his son over and he said a prayer. And I couldn't stop. I'm like, I haven't cried in front of anybody in forever. I'm sobbing on the phone with this kid. He's like, if you need me, you know where to find me. And he hangs up the phone. From that point forward, now up until that point, I was averaging about 1.6, 1.8 miles an hour for the last 4 or 5 hours. I was limping. I couldn't run. Something happened at that point where the best word I can use to describe what happened, if it were in a single word, would be unencumbered. It was as though I was unencumbered. And from going from 1.4, 1.6 mile an hour average, I ran to the next hotel, which was about 11 miles away, at an average of 7.2, with no pain, no nothing. I had 28 pounds of gear on my back. I get to the hotel. I check into the hotel. I'm like, it was about 4 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm like, I'm just going to eat. I'm going to rest, you know, do some meditation, take an ice bath, like just chill. I get to the hotel. First thing I do when I go into any hotel room, anybody will tell you, I go in the drawer, I take the Bible out and I put it on the counter. Now, you know, I'm not Bible thumping or anything like that. My point is that it's a book, it's a spiritual book. It means a lot of things to a lot of people. And it would be appropriate if I showed this thing some respect. The last time it seen the light of day was the day it was put in there. So I take the Bible out of the drawer and I put it on the desk. And in the book is a bookmark. So I open the book to the bookmark, and where the hell is this bookmark set? Put in the book of Matthew chapter 5, which is the Beatitudes, right? The meek shall inherit the earth, yada, yada, yada. And there was, I cried my eyes out while I read the whole chapter. I'm like, this is here for a reason. I felt like Tyler Durden in Fight Club. Like, I was already here and this is what I set up for myself to give myself the boost that I needed. And I'll thank me for it later. So I read the chapter and got my sleep that night. I remember my wife, when I talked to her, she was worried about me. She's like, you know, what's going on? The very last words I told my wife before I left the house, and she'll tell you this. I said, I love you. I said, no matter what I say when I call you, do not come and pick me up. No matter what I tell you, when you answer that phone, leave me where I am. The only way I'm coming home is when I get to DC. So, you know, those were her instructions. I knew that she knew that I was in a really bad place at that time. And I know that it hurt her to feel me like that. But in any event, the next morning I woke up bright and early. I ran from Bird in Hand, Pennsylvania to York, Pennsylvania, which I think was about 37 miles away. And I did it in, 9 hours, 10 hours. This is day 5 or 6 or something. Then the following day, it was like 20 something miles. The following day. So it was just home run after home run. So whatever happened, and I don't know if it was just a matter that I didn't feel like I was alone anymore because my friend called me and I felt like he was on my team, or maybe it was some sort of divine intervention. But the fact of the matter is that the bruises on the top of my feet disappeared. And the swelling in my knee had gone. It wasn't swollen. Like, I felt like $1 million. And what that taught me, just in terms of a mindset and a performance sense, is that the universe doesn't do favors, right? You could ask the universe all day long, please let me get an A on this test. You know, please let the check be in the mail today. The universe doesn't have time for that shit because there's 7.5 billion people begging for little stuff like that. What the universe does is miracles. And you don't have to say you believe in miracles or in the universe or whatever words you want to use. You just have to demonstrate that. And I got up that next day and I hit it like a bat out of hell. And I felt like whatever power governs this whole show said, you know what? We can't stop this guy. He's just going to go. So let him pass. And from that point forward, I realized that it's not just me, it's anybody. Like, if you put your head in a place where this shit is already done, and what you're doing is you're just basically satisfying the requirements of a past necessary for you to have accomplished a particular goal, you just turn this thing off and you'll get there. Just let your body move through time and space as it's supposed to in order to create the past necessary for you to achieve what it is, the goals that you set. And you could literally do everything. It's when you second guess it every step of the way. Ouch, this hurts. Maybe this isn't a good idea. Ouch, this hurts. Maybe I should stop doing this. Man, I don't know if I could ever accomplish anything like that. Like, that's poison. But if you set your heart on something, it's almost like the universe conspires to make it so for you. But you've got to prove that you're worthy and you're not just one of these people that keeps your fingers crossed in hopes that, you know, you don't hit any red lights on your way to work today. And that's really the biggest lesson that I learned from running down there. I felt like once I showed that I wasn't going to stop and that I was going to keep going no matter what, the fucking Red Sea parted and I made my way right to where I was going without a problem. And then I arrived in DC the day after the George Floyd protests got there. And, you know, that was quite an experience in and of itself. And I feel honored to have seen that and been a part of that piece of history. But in any event, that's kind of how I got it. I guess that's the long answer to how did I get into endurance stuff and ultra running. But that's really what set it off for me and just proved to me that anything's possible. So I've taken that to the nth degree. So, you know, workouts of 1500 tire sledges, you know, takes me an hour and a half, or, you know, I'll hop on the rower and I'll do a 1 hour sprint, 15,000 meters with the oxygen mask on, knowing that as long as I just keep trying to stay ahead of it, you know, that it's not going to catch up to me. And, you know, I guess it's that mindset that really put me in a place where I found myself in an ER last night, and I found out that I've got rhabdo, and you know, they sent me home, so I guess it can't be all that bad.
Maybe one level before rhabdo. It sounds like you've been able to find meditation through intense, grueling, soul-sucking workouts. And were you born with that ability to just shut down the voice in your head doubting around every corner? Or did you cultivate that somehow?
You know, I don't know the answer to that question. But what I do tell myself and remind myself is it's a line that I repeat over and over in my head, and that's bury it fast and bury it deep. Just get it the fuck out of here. So, you know, if I'm running and I feel something hurt, you know, you get a stitch in your side, that'll drop anybody. I get a stitch in my side right away. You know, I tell them, I'm like, bury it fast and bury it deep. Get it out of here. There's not even language of words for it. It doesn't exist. Pain is just a sensation, just like temperature, just like smell, just like anything else. Bury it fast and bury it deep. And I don't know if that's like a protective mechanism of, you know, something that I learned when I was a child because of, you know, whatever reason. I don't know. I know that our tolerance to pain is very much like our tolerance to cold. It's something that we acquire. You know, some people are freezing cold when it's 62 degrees out. Some people are sweating when it's 62 degrees out. And it can go either way. You know, you can, you know, why do we turn the heat on in the wintertime to 68, but in the summertime we turn the air on to 62? Wasn't 62 good enough in the summer? It should be good enough in the winter. So it's almost as though our headspace around any particular activity really sets the boundaries for what we're going to find to be acceptable or not. And if you can put it out of your mind long enough and not give it an opportunity to say the things that it wants to say, you basically neglect it from being part of the conversation and you stop it from having a voice, and you just bury it fast and bury it deep. Just get it out of here.
I too learned at a young age that pain is a sensation that we can override and over time, like cold or heat, build tolerance to. And at the same time, there's a side of me that thinks in some situation, pain is warranted and it might not be a good idea to override it.
Mm-hmm.
How do you balance the two? How do you know when it's a good time or when you should listen to it?
I agree with you 100%. And it would be foolish not to, right? I mean, there's, you're not going to keep your hand on the stove and think like, I could think myself through this. So, you know, I don't know the answer to that question, but what I believe is that in large part, we all choose the thing that's going to kill us. We all decide what we're going to die from. And it's the thing that we fixate on and we continue to remind ourselves that it's a problem. And because we continue to remind ourselves a problem, I feel like that manifests itself in the quantum field or whatever it is. The universe hears it and says, okay, well, if that's what you want, then that's what you get. You know, if we think about it, when we're a young child and we bang our elbow on the table, and I've got three kids. When I see them bang their elbow on the table, you know, they'll cry about it. They'll whine about it. They'll bitch about it until something else grabs their attention and then they're off. That's going to happen a certain amount of times until it just never really matters anymore. You know, here you and I are, right? We're pretty fit guys. You know, I like to think, you know, we're somewhere on the alpha spectrum. And when we bang our elbow, we don't even think about it. But the brain still interprets that the same exact way. If you hooked you up to a brain scan, the brain scan that the waves that would create when you banged your elbow when you were 5 years old and the waves that it creates when you bang your elbow right now are exactly the same. Okay, what's different is the way that we interpret it. Now, if we didn't find a way to bury it back then, it would still bother us to the same degree and we'd all be whiny babies. But if we convinced ourselves that we have an elbow banging problem and that this every time this happens, it hurts really badly, all we're doing is solidifying that in our own psyche and our mentality that this is a problem. It is meant to be a problem. It will always be a problem no matter what. And because of that, we're always going to have elbow problems throughout our entire life. So how do I balance it? You know, I guess I just use common sense, and I've got a pretty low aversion to risk. So I'm willing to try anything a few times. And I think like a lot of athletes out there, you know, that the first handful of miles are a liar. You'll run, your feet will hurt. Probably in your first 3 or 4 miles, you've come up with a dozen reasons why you could stop and it would make 100% sense. But if you stopped for any one of those reasons, then that's going to stick with you. And the reason why you stopped this time is because your knee hurt. It's going to hurt again next time. It's going to hurt again next time. And then eventually you're going to get it scoped and find out you have arthritis. And now you're going to have surgery. And now you got knee problems for the rest of your life. Or you can just ignore it and say, you know, well, what's on the other side? Can I run through it? How high of a threshold do I have? And when you run through all of those little ails and all those little pains for the first couple of miles, you know, lo and behold, you're at mile 6 or 7 and there's just a general suck to it. There's nothing in particular that really hurts anymore. So if we were to have taken any of the off-roads that we had during those first handful of miles, because it was my foot hurt or I've got shin splints now, or, you know, I've got a cramp, then we would have never have realized that those really are inconsequential to the overall goal in and of itself. So I give myself the opportunity to just explore that and see how far I can push it. I mean, you know, when you can't go on anymore and you know that the body's just not going to move that way. But if it's just coming from your mind, if it's just an ethereal sense of pain and discomfort, then that's subjective and it's variable depending on the day. If it's a true and real sense of pain that's causing you a number of issues or any number of issues, then that's something different. But I tell my clients, pain is never okay. Exercise is supposed to be uncomfortable. You draw the line wherever you want, but I want you to challenge yourself because there's things about you that you don't know yet. So explore it. Don't be afraid to take it a half a step too far. So, you know, I'm not afraid to take it a couple of half a steps too far to see what's on the other side. And just in my own experience and trying out a number of different things, I know that so far, 99% of the time, I'm full of shit and I can just keep going. as long as I stick it out for long enough, all the problems I think I have just go away. So I think it's part low aversion to risk. I think it's part, you know, probably part stupidity. And at the other time, on the other side of things, it's also an effort to explore my own potential, you know, my own abilities. And if I stopped every time I got uncomfortable, I would have never have gotten off the couch 22 years ago and decided to do something different.
Your mind processing pain is also a shortcut, an easy way out for it. So that if it registers this is painful or makes you think it is, then all of a sudden it doesn't have to work as much. So then that threshold, if you're not aware of it, instead of building, it goes down. What's your take on supplements, compounds, pre-workouts, post-workouts, intro workouts, all that stuff? I'm going to assume, given your story, that you don't regularly use it.
No, I used to when I was really into more weightlifting, but now that I'm just into overall, you know, cardio, strength, high intensity stuff, mobility stuff, I don't take anything. I don't really recommend very much either. I think the things that we convince ourselves that we need end up becoming the reason why we fail in the long term anyway. You know, I didn't have my pre-workout, so that workout sucked. It's all placebo. I mean, sure, there's some physiological benefit to it. It's measurable. You know, cell volume increases and circulation increases, metabolism increases and all that. But you don't need any of that. You don't. Does it help performance? It might help immediate performance, but I think in large part, it's really no different than wearing a back brace or wrist wraps or platform shoes when you deadlift. We're using it to shore up our weaknesses when weaknesses is in fact what we need to be developing. So if your grip strength sucks, that's not an excuse to get wrist wraps and go heavier. That's an excuse to improve your grip, your functional grip strength, and just be a better deadlifter. You know, if you need these shoes that mold to the bottoms of your feet and give you a perfectly flat surface to connection to the floor, I don't think that you're really deadlifting. You're really not that strong. You're not as strong as you represent yourself to be, because you need a back brace to keep your back from falling apart. You need knee wraps to keep your knees from exploding, wrist wraps to keep your grip strength going on, and platform shoes because, I don't know, you like to wear heels when you deadlift. You know, that to me just shows me that you're not that strong. You might be able to pull the bar off the floor, and if those rules are legal in the competition, then that's fine. But at the end of the day, you're not functionally strong. You're taped together. You know, what's next? You're going to have somebody lift it for you? Like, none of that shit really, really helps you in any way. It helps your ego, but in terms of overall performance and functional performance, it doesn't do anything. And I think the same is true for pre-workouts and thermogenics and everything else, that, you know, they're making up for your shortcomings when really all you have to do is just pay a little bit more attention or try a little bit harder, spend a little bit more time doing what you need to do, or research and figure out, is there a better way than what I'm doing right now? So when it comes to recommending supplements, there's very few that I recommend. I do recommend that everybody take a high quality multivitamin, everybody, because food just isn't the same as it was back in the early 1900s when we measured the amount of vitamins and nutrients that are in the vegetables and the meats and so on and so forth. Carrots that are grown today are not grown in the same soil that they were grown in 100 years ago. That soil has been raped and pillaged and fertilized since then. So this, the way the thing that you're eating sure looks like a carrot, but it's not the same carrot that it used to be. And that's measurable too. We know that for a fact, that these things have a fraction of the nutrient value that they had when the RDA first came up with their bullshit guidelines and put together all these, you know, nutrition facts for us. So multivitamin absolutely helps fill in the cracks. It's not a performance enhancer. It's a lifestyle optimizer. It helps our bodies not stress in order to get the things that it needs to make more human. Another thing I recommend is BCAAs after a particularly arduous strength training workout in particular. You know, the studies show, and there's plenty of it to back it up, that it keeps your body from going into a catabolic state and just gives your body more of the amino acids that it needs to build the muscle so it doesn't have to rob Peter to pay Paul. Anybody that lifts weights in the gym and has a ridiculously big upper body and skinny ass legs, it's because their body knows that here in my quads, I have this tremendous human protein reservoir that I'm not using. So when you do arms 3 times a week or chest 3 times a week and your diet sucks, even if you are supplementing your crappy protein, what you're doing is you're telling your body, take it from where I don't need it and repurpose it where I do. So you're just shuffling the deck around. You're not building anything. You're just moving the furniture. So BCAAs in part help prevent that from happening in such a large scale, or at least in as much of a degree as it could. And fish oil. I'm a firm believer that fish oil helps facilitate the transport of nutrients in and out of synovial joints and synovial capsules. It also molecularly closely mimics the gray matter in our brain. It's also got measurable heart benefits and, you know, helps keep the blood thin enough to circulate in, you know, adverse situations and things like that. So it's really those three: fish oils, BCAAs, and a multivitamin. The multivitamin is really the only one that I would categorically recommend. The other two, you know, it really depends on where the client's at, what their goals are. You know, I would say that there's certainly some subjectivity to that.
You prefer branched chain amino acids, BCAAs, over essential amino acids or complete aminos?
I prefer whole food completely. But as far as the essential amino acids, I mean, we certainly, they're essential. But BCAAs, I would say that something in that particular case is better than nothing. If you don't have a diet sufficient to satisfy your machine with the building blocks that it needs during the time of most stress. And that's not, you know, your favorite vanilla flavored whey protein. That's literally the flavorless building blocks that your body can kind of piece out and, you know, put where it needs to get you to your next meal or to get you to your next whole consumption, you know, consumption of whole foods that are born of the substances that they come in, you know, like eat the whole piece of meat. Don't just supplement the protein. Eat dark leafy vegetables, eat a variety of different fibers and a variety of different fruits and vegetables. So that way you can get all of the pieces as they were intended. We don't know. We still don't know the things that exist within the foods that our body uses or the relationships that they have with the other things in the foods. So for us to start picking stuff out of, you know, the vitamin shelf at CVS, we don't know. Trust me when I tell you, you don't know better than nature. You just don't. So go for what nature gives you. Okay. Nature's got it down. You know, Healthy Choice or whatever, you know, your vitamin company is, doesn't. Pretty much guarantee you that.
Yeah. In recent years, I've moved away from isolates and synthetic versions of what I can find naturally. And even including in my training, I've moved away from the wrist wraps, the knee wraps, the special shoes, ditched all that, and figured that maybe on game day it could help for an acute one-off. But if I'm training like this and then I go try and train without it, I can't perform. And ultimately, what's the point of getting really strong in this narrow range of exercise when 99.9% of my life, I'm not in that range?
That's exactly right.
If we're not using all these other things that are commonly used in the fitness sector, what are some of the other tips that you like or ways of boosting performance?
Peel it back as far as we can. You know, how are we supposed to move? How are we supposed to eat? How are we supposed to rest? And how are we supposed to breathe? I think that those are really the critical pieces. You know, cavemen did just fine for tens of thousands of years, eating the whole animal, eating organ meats, eating fermented foods, eating bone broths and things like that. Varied sort of, there's 600,000, something crazy, like 600,000 different varieties of edible vegetation on this planet. But 80% of this planet's vegetative intake comes from just three of them. So we need to get back to variety. Variety of food, variety of movement. You know, if you look at, you know, I think squatting is very much like swimming. You can take a newborn child and put them in a pool and they'll actually swim. We forget how to swim and then we have to relearn it again. Squatting. I mean, I've got a 3-year-old little girl, and I can tell you when she sits on the floor and she plays, and when she squats on the floor and she plays, she's dead nuts right in a perfect squat. Her weight's back on her heels, her chest is up, her butt is down. Everything is exactly where it needs to be. So I think going back to fundamentals, there's never a bad time to go back to fundamentals. And you ask any professional that when they get bogged down by the minutiae and the details of a complicated task or a complicated endeavor, going back to what the textbook says always freaking works. It's basics. We need to stick to the basics. Now we've got shake weights, and now we've got this funky thing that we put on our head and attached to a cable machine so we can do this shit. Like, that stuff is just so unimportant. And to your point before about getting away from the wraps and the straps, and that there's a difference between a one-off kind of thing, I had a conversation with a very good friend of mine about that. He wanted me to critique his deadlift form, and he's got the fancy shoes, he's got the belt, he's got the wraps, and I told him, get rid of it. Just get rid of it all. Well, you know, I need it. I said, there's a difference between preparation and preparation for a performance. So you want to train everything. You want your grip strength to suffer during your practices. You want your core to have to engage extra hard in order to satisfy those structural requirements of integrity. You want to work out in bare feet. You need those stabilizers. Then when it comes time to just rip one off the floor, you know, you want to deadlift 450. Like, you can do that, and you'll be able to do it a lot easier because you trained without all that fancy stuff. So I agree that, you know, in preparation for an activity, you really want to make it as difficult as you can be, because when the performance comes, you've actually worked on many of the things that are your weakest points. And now when you shore up those weak points and they're already better established, your performance is going to be superior no matter what. So I agree with that. I agree with that 100%.
In terms of economy of movement and variety of movement, I was ironically running the other day, and I was thinking about how when I was playing competitive American football and rugby, we would do all sorts of lateral movements and backpedaling and these other different types. And since I stopped, I no longer do that, and I realized that I'm missing out on some of those stabilizer muscles, and different like bodily systems are no longer being used. And since you do a lot of running now, but do you do anything for the other systems?
So I do. The lunges, that's really just more of a novelty for me. I mean, it is technically a low impact movement. It's a relatively unstable movement. We're moving in the same plane that we would move when we were running, but I don't do it to complement my running. I look at things really in a purely functional sense, that, you know, the best way to get better at running is to run. The best way to get better at sprinting is to sprint. You know, you want bigger arms, you got to work your arms. Sure, there are accessory lifts and exercises that we can incorporate that would help certain inadequacies when it comes to running, but no better than running actually would. So I wear minimalistic footwear. I've got a zero drop shoe on. I've got them on right now. I've got two pairs. They're the only two pairs of shoes that I wear anywhere. And I know that having a more complete connection to the ground, which is really where our stability and our support begin. We've got so many nerve endings in our feet. We've got 33 some odd joints in the feet. But for me, allowing those muscles to do their job, allowing the foundation of this structure really to behave in the way that the foundation of the structure was intended, I think allows me to do a lot of other things. One thing I've noticed, actually, I've been wearing these zero drop shoes for about a year now.
What company?
Zero, actually.
Oh yeah, XERO. I wear the same ones, and I train in them as well.
I love them, and you know, they've got an insole that you can put in to give you a couple millimeters. I've got the insoles out. Mm-hmm. They're basically just treads on the bottom of my feet, yep. So they don't get all jacked up. But you can feel everything. Mm-hmm. It took me about a year to adapt to them.
It takes time.
A lot of time, and it hurts, you know, yeah. Especially when you use them, you go from not using them at all to using them exclusively. You know, there's certainly an acclimation process. But having that connection to the ground and letting all of those joints and all of those muscles work effectively and in the way that they were intended, I think gives me a whole lot more. One, it gives me a lot more feedback from the ground. I know what my feet are telling me. I know what the ground is telling me. And my brain just naturally has become accustomed to knowing what to do with that information. But it also helps me when I run. It helps me when I do any of the other exercises that I do where, you know, my feet are connected to the ground. But I don't really do anything in order to do anything else. I mean, if it's something that I'm doing, I lunge so I can get better at lunging. You know, I run so I can get better at running. And I tell my clients the same thing, particularly with stretching, as a matter of fact. Arbitrarily stretching is no better than arbitrarily strengthening things. You know, we want to maintain a functional level of fitness. Functional for this decade in our life might mean that the hamstrings have to maintain a certain degree of tension more than they would have to maintain the next decade of our life, depending on what our habits are and so on and so forth. So really just training the body to do what we want the body to do and nothing else, I think, aids in the economy of movement and also aids in the economy and the use of our time. We're not arbitrarily stretching things. We're not arbitrarily working out things. You know, I'm doing things that pique my interest. I'm making sure that I maintain a balance, a muscular balance, that my movement systems are all in aligned and everything works well for what I need them for right now. But, you know, I don't know. And when I hit 50, I might want to be a trapeze artist, in which case my legs aren't going to mean anything to me anymore. And it's going to be all upper body stuff that I'm going to focus on. And then I will. So it's really just focusing on what it is that you want to achieve, what it is that you want to improve, and then doing that over and over again.
So it's a compatible plan, and then also it fits into whatever you're training. So if you want to run, you run. If you want to lift weights, you lift weights more.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Back to the whole simplicity idea.
Right.
Well, Matt, it's getting late over here. I do have one final question for you. But before we get to that, how can my audience that's interested connect with you and find you on social media?
Thank you for asking. So you could find me at Matt Scarfo just about anywhere. MattScarf as in Frank O. I'm Matt Scarfo on Instagram. I'm really active on Instagram, YouTube. I'm getting my game up on YouTube. You can find me on YouTube, Matt Scarfo, LinkedIn as well, matt@mattscarfo.com, or you can just Google Matt Scarfo. I'm pretty sure I'm the first thing that pops up when you do that.
Now imagine if we were to take that same idea and erase all educational material from Earth. There's no knowledge and it's up to you. You get to choose what survives. You get 3 books, teachers, videos, podcasts, lectures, you name it. And that's all that's going to be on Earth. What would you choose?
So I'm looking at my bookshelf here. And, you know, I would... People are going to judge me when I answer this question. There's so much context that this deserves, but the Bible is the first one that absolutely would have to stay, because I don't think it was meant to be interpreted literally in large part. I think there's stories in there that we have only yet begun to comprehend. And I'm not talking about, you know, the walking on water bit, but I think there's a lot of history in there that we don't give it the credit that it deserves. So I'm going to say the Bible. I'm also going to pick The 12th Planet by Zechariah Sitchin. If anybody has read it, they know. You know what? The third one, I'm going to pick the book called Breathe by James Nestor. It's probably one of my favorite books. Top 3 favorite books that I've read in the last 5 years, Breathe by James Nestor. He's a really great guy. He's a fantastic author. He's a great researcher. And the information, the anecdotal and experimental information that's in that book, Breathe by James Nestor, I think would serve to benefit every single person on this planet. And furthermore, I think that it's written in such a way that every single person on this planet would enjoy reading it. And no, he's not paying me to say that.
That's the one on your list that I've thoroughly read from page to page as well. And lots of practical tips in there. Breath work goes far beyond just the Wim Hof method, although I like totally. That one too.
Yep.
But that's a good list, diverse list.
Yeah, and you know, interestingly enough, the Bible and the 12th planet, there's some congruence between the two. If you're bold enough to read them both, I think that you'll agree.
I like it. Well, Matt, it's been a pleasure chatting with you today, and I look forward to reconnecting down the line.
Yeah, I really appreciate your time and attention, and thank you for your audience for listening. Thank you.
Thank you for tuning in to this episode. Head over to Apple Music, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts and leave a rating. Every review helps me bring you thought-provoking guests. As always, you can find the show notes for this one at mindbodypeak.com/episode. There, you can also chat with other peak performers or connect with me directly. The information depicted in this podcast is for information purposes only. Please consult your primary healthcare professional before making any lifestyle changes.